Well, welcome everyone to another edition of Indie Week. Reading for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners, this is John Feddersen with the latest issue, which is dated March the 24th of 2021. And, of course, thanks today are due to our guest musicians rendering today's theme song. And today, our selection is the Magic Bowl Movement from the Symphony in C Minus by Hieronymus Blücher. The duet has made their name on this repertoire, and their name, Bellows and Strunk. Thank you, folks, and we'll listen for you at the end of our broadcast. So let's get going. I believe we will get started with the hard news column, the first from Raleigh by Jane Porter, called Rules of Engagement. It's been a little over a year since Raleigh's city council abolished its support for citizen advisory councils, CACs, in an unannounced vote. Now the city is getting a framework in place to engage Raleigh residents in new ways it hopes will be more far-reaching, inclusionary, and effective. But even with a year-long community engagement study that cost upward of $70,000, the specter of the CACs, which still operate without city support, continues to loom large. In his 18-page report to the city council last week, Mickey Fearn, the consultant the city hired to study and make recommendations on how the city can best engage its residents with government processes and initiatives, all but suggests resurrecting CACs, or community and neighborhood organizations, alongside several other actionable initiatives, Fearn told the council during his final presentation at its March 16th meeting. Whatever's going to replace the CACs, whatever's going to look like or do what they did, then the city needs to provide support for those organizations. Throughout the study process, Fearn noticed a lack of trust between citizens and the city council, as well as frustration and resentment tied to the council's decision to withdraw its support of the nearly 50-year-old citizen groups without public input. He also noted the problems that existed with the 18 CACs, including the way they unevenly engaged citizens. Some were too large, comprising tens of thousands of households across massive geographical areas, while some were small, comprising just a few thousand households in a handful of neighborhoods. People who attended different CACs had different concerns, such as planning and zoning in wealthier CACs versus concerns about basic human services like food deserts, education, and crime in the poorer areas. There were also logistical problems. Meetings often occurred on weekday evenings and could be difficult for CACs to find volunteers to lead them. Fearn said at that meeting, the challenge with the historical CAC structure is that it was not necessarily inclusionary, and that it was not the entire umbrella for all the things that needed to go on in community engagement in the city. But the function that it served was absolutely critical. That structure is fine, as long as it doesn't pretend to be the total of community engagement in the city, because there are so many activities and things that need to be done other than what the CACs did. In his report, Fearn also recommends assembling two committees, one internal and one external, for community engagement. Those committees will start out small, Fearn says, and grow to add more members as needed. He told the Indy in an email, initially, the external task force will be comprised of individuals who have shown significant interest in the future of community engagement in Raleigh. They are constituents with whom I have been engaged over the last year. Some of them were allies, some adversaries, a few have been both. We are also engaging ethnic and cultural community organizations, North Carolina State, the Raleigh Chamber, and a few other community organizations. Christina Jones, head of the Raleigh CAC grassroots organization as it exists today, told Indy she was invited to serve on the External Community Engagement Task Force, along with seven other CAC leaders. She sees Fern's report as seeming to propose reestablishing CACs, in that it suggests creating community organizations to work with various city departments, such as housing and neighborhoods, planning, parks, recreation, and cultural resources, with city fundings. Jones says it recommends exactly what CACs were, so I'm confused. I'm not against creating something new, not at all, but I'm confused as to why CACs had to be disbanded for an entire year before we came up with that. Still, Jones says she has been thinking about ways to make these new community organizations better, including potentially aligning them with the city's 28 community centers, therefore serving 10 more locations around the city than the 18 CACs reached. Jones also supports another major recommendation in Fern's report, the creation of a city office or department dedicated to community engagement that answers directly to the city manager. A member of the city's Parks Advisory Board, Jones says, a department dedicated to engaging citizens would be helpful to city staffers who are tasked simultaneously with having to create major plans for city projects and having to engage citizens with those plans. Jones says staff are trying to do so much to develop an entire plan, and to ask them to do community engagement too is unfair. A department dedicated to that would help so many within city departments as well as residents of the city. The mayor and several council members told Indy last week that creating a community engagement office is a top priority for the council and will be funded in this year's city budget. Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin says, we feel that elevating a community engagement office under the city manager's office sends a message of value. Fern's report gave no cost estimate for that proposal, but Baldwin says the community engagement initiatives will likely occur gradually. Quote, we don't know what the numbers look like yet, but we've talked about a potentially phased approach in two budget years. Councilmember Jonathan Melton says he sees the proposal for renewed city support for community organizations in Fern's report as a move toward a more decentralized way of communicating with citizens. He says there are multiple ways to get information to folks. Folks will look toward their community organizations for information, and the city is working to do a better job of being more accessible. We've talked a lot about trying to find people where they are. How do we find that person that works the third shift and can't go to a neighborhood meeting? How do we reach the person who has two jobs or is a single parent, or the person who has been disengaged? I think Mickey's report speaks more to that work. Councilmember David Cox, whose vote was one of two against abolishing city support for CACs last February, is not enthused about the prospect of creating a new city department to facilitate community engagement. He wrote in an email to the Indy, the formation of a community engagement department will simply continue to obfuscate and shove serious community engagement out of sight and out of mind. He said the city is worse off for community engagement than it was a year ago, and that he is disappointed in the community engagement report, which he found, quote, lacking in specifics. Cox was a major proponent of the CACs and advocated for reforming them. At a work session in October, when Fern presented an update on his community engagement study, Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin said that, over the last decade, the council tried several times to reform CACs with no success. She said at the time, attempts were made to unify, regulate, and make CACs more friendly towards members of the community who did not participate. There was resistance to change. If we could change CACs, we would have. With Fern's final report in the hands of city staff and recommendations to the internal and external committees to be completed this week. Recommendations for specific actions, such as how to create and pay for a community engagement office, will go back before the council in May. And Fern wrote in his indie email, I want to stress that anyone who wants to engage can. As our work plan becomes more defined, we will be establishing groups to lead various aspects of the work plan. In addition, anyone is invited and encouraged to contact city staff and me anytime they have a contribution to make. Next, More of the Same by Sarah Pequeno. Two bills in the North Carolina General Assembly threaten immigrant families. If it feels like we've been here before, it's because we have. Jones Street was screaming on a recent Tuesday afternoon. In front of the legislative building, the city scene was chaotic, cars honking against each other, moving slower than the water droplets rolling off the signs taped to their windows and hoods. Stop terrorizing immigrant families, the signs read. Stop Senate Bill 101. Caravana en contra de SB 101 and HB 62. As the blinking cars circled the block, El Colectivo NC representatives held a press conference inside the building to oppose two bills that immigrant advocates are urging Governor Roy Cooper to veto. Senator Wiley Nickel, a Democrat from Kerry, recalled that Cooper vetoed similar legislation in 2019. The governor called it partisan political pandering, with the intention of scoring partisan political points and using fear to divide North Carolina. Now, Nickel said, version 2.0 is just more of the same. In February, Republicans in both legislative chambers filed bills aiming to force local governments to cooperate with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Nickel referred to Senate Bill 101, entitled Require Cooperation with ICE 2.0. The second bill, House Bill 62, is known as Government Immigration Compliance. The two bills are slightly different. The House bill nullifies the sanctuary ordinances in local communities, meaning that local law enforcement would have to enforce federal immigration laws. The Senate bill would require law enforcement to look into the immigration status of anyone charged with certain crimes, such as felony drug charges and misdemeanors or felony assault. They'd also have to follow ICE detainers and report the number of times they make a query to ICE or how many times someone was detained or released because of their immigration status. Representative Ricky Hurtado, Democrat of Alamance, said at the press conference, Let me be clear, HB 62 is just flat-out terrible policy. House Republicans want to open the floodgates to harassment and discrimination from an unlimited number of baseless lawsuits from literally anyone in the community. And the standing to sue is rooted in the concept of sanctuary that we don't even have a formal definition for. The anti-immigrant group Center for Immigration Studies says North Carolina has 6 sanctuary jurisdictions, more than any other state in the South. In our state, these jurisdictions are areas where law enforcement does not have to act on ICE detainers, which aren't binding anyway, but policy varies across the country. Sanctuary jurisdictions comply with federal law and don't shield undocumented migrants from being charged with crimes, according to the American Immigration Council. North Carolina ordinances received attention when former President Donald Trump started promoting his mass deportation agenda and disdain for sanctuary cities. Buncombe and Forsyth counties enacted ordinances in February of 2019. A month later, the first compliance requirement bill was filed in the State House. The 2019 bill was ratified and sent to the governor in August of that year. He vetoed it the next day. The bill went back into the House and sat dormant for the rest of that session. At the time, State Senator Chuck Edwards, Republican of Buncombe, said that Cooper was siding with the Mecklenburg Sheriff's Department after the department did not comply with a detainer for an undocumented immigrant who posted bond twice after being charged with kidnapping and assault. Edwards filed the 2021 Senate bill, which is almost word for word the bill from 2019. And he said in a statement, "I cannot fathom how anybody could support shielding an illegal immigrant who rapes or murders a North Carolinian. Removing violent criminals who are here illegally should be a unanimous priority." Despite Edwards' feelings, multiple national studies have found no correlation between sanctuary municipalities and higher crime rates. These ordinances could actually deter crime, sociologists say, by building trust. Hurtado mentioned this on Tuesday. If this bill becomes law, it sows distrust in the immigrant community, leading to lower levels of cooperation with law enforcement and local government. Dory McMillan, the governor's press secretary, called the bills unconstitutional and said they, quote, will cost the state significant resources to defend and, worse, spark fear that exploits for political gain. If Cooper vetoes either bill, it's unlikely that Republicans could pull off an override. If they somehow did make it work, minority groups, such as those included in El Colectivo, would likely sue the state. Florida passed a similar law in 2019. Multiple groups sued, and the complaints are still being litigated in federal court. These also aren't the only two anti-immigrant bills filed this session. The Verification of Immigration Status, or the SAVE Act, whose primary sponsor also authored HB 62, would require licensing boards and benefit services to have applicants' immigration status verified. Undocumented migrants are already barred from licensing and benefits by the federal government. This bill is still in committee. Hurtado noted that the state and country face a lot of challenges at the moment, but immigrants going on crime sprees and abusing government benefits are not among them. He said, "We need to prioritize what's important for our working families, focus on economic security, access to health care, getting our kids back in school, not this political fear-mongering that continues to divide us. If we've learned anything in the last 4 years, it's that this just puts us down a bad road." Continuing now from Jeff West, game changer. Anti-poverty advocates rejoice over a new child tax credit. More than a decade ago, Sheila Arias, a single mother in Durham, gave birth to her first child, a daughter with special needs, whose medical condition required surgeries and therapies that mounted into hundreds of thousands of dollars in medical debt. Arias, a campaign organizer for Moms Rising, says paying for the ongoing cost of care while providing for her now 9-year-old son hasn't been easy, but recent stimulus checks have helped, and her new full-time job offers hopes. "Financially, I'm going to be stable," Arias says, "but I'm not there yet." For her and millions of other North Carolinians, additional help is on the way. Tucked inside the recently signed coronavirus relief bill was a revolutionary provision to aid families that local anti-poverty advocates have dubbed a game changer, unprecedented, a dream come true, and long overdue. The provision, included in the American Rescue Plan, raises the existing federal child tax credit that families can use to reduce their tax bill from $2,000 per child to $3,600 for children under the age of 6 and $3,000 for children ages 6 to 17. The new measure also eliminates a minimum income requirement to qualify for the tax credit, opening the door to low-income earners. But the real revolution is that the credits will be paid out in monthly installments, creating almost a child allowance or guaranteed income source for families. Those fighting child poverty say this money will have a profound impact on the lives of North Carolinians. As early as July, families can expect to receive $300 a month for each child under 6 and $250 per child under 18, a temporary benefit that will last through December, although Democratic lawmakers hope to make the new credit permanent. Michelle Hughes, an executive director of NC Child, a Raleigh-based advocacy group for children, says, "It's hard to find enough superlatives to describe the significance of the American Rescue Plan and the Child Tax Credit in particular in addressing child poverty. Most of us have never seen public policy addressing poverty on this scale in our lifetimes." Other advocates from nonprofits working to help struggling families overcome lackluster social safety nets that don't go far enough to aid an unacceptable number of children living in poverty share this sentiment. Sharon Goodson, executive director of the anti-poverty nonprofit North Carolina Community Action Association, says the new Child Tax Credit is in the single most impactful legislation strategically targeted to address the needs of low-wealth children and families since President Lyndon B. Johnson's War on Poverty. Johnson's War on Poverty initiatives included, among other things, the creation of Medicaid, food stamps, and special funding for schools in low-income areas. Similar to those anti-poverty programs, the monthly aid provided by the Child Tax Credit will, quote, help to eliminate some of the despair and anxiety that struggling, poor families experience every day, says Goodson. Having the resources to move a step beyond poverty is a dream come true for the families that we serve. It's hard to overstate the significance of the expanded tax credit for low-income families. Information released by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found more than 2.6 million children in North Carolina stand to benefit from the credit, and the Center on Budget and Policy has calculated the legislation will move 137,000 North Carolina children out of poverty. Nationwide, the credit is projected to cut in half the number of children living in so-called deep poverty, or in households whose incomes are 50% below the poverty line, and reduce the overall number of children in poverty by about 40%. According to an analysis by the Niskanen Center, a center-right think tank. The new credit will cut poverty rates in part through its unique delivery system of providing half of the money through monthly allowances, with the other half available when parents file taxes next year. Chance Van Noppen, executive director of St. Xavier's Center, says spreading out this support can provide a comfort to parents, knowing this benefit is sustained over a period of time. I think we're all comfortable with saying that we're living in unique times. Although I can't say this level of support is surprising, it's certainly unprecedented. A key piece of the expanded child tax credit is the elimination of those income requirements. Previously, households had to report an annual income of at least $2,500 to qualify, and low-income earners might only qualify for a $1,400 credit rather than the maximum $2,000. Eliminating the income requirement makes the credit available to an additional 27 million children, according to data from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a progressive think tank. Hughes says, "One of the best parts of the new child tax credit is that it now includes the lowest earners, people whose incomes were so low they're not required to file a federal tax return. They had previously been left out of the child tax credit, and now they will qualify. That is huge for kids in the very poorest families." While the changes were enacted to benefit low-income families, the monthly payments will only go to families in the IRS database. In other words, those who haven't filed taxes because their incomes didn't meet the minimum threshold will need to self-identify with the IRS to take advantage. For instance, a married couple who earned less than $24,800 in 2020 is not required to file federal taxes this year, while a single person who earned less than $12,400 also wouldn't need to file. Alexandra Forter-Sirota, director of the Budget and Tax Center at the North Carolina Justice Center, said, "One of the greatest challenges in North Carolina will be the need for robust outreach and education, a way for low-income families who haven't been filing taxes to file taxes so they can be connected to this support." The IRS plans to design an online system for non-filers to report their status that would identify those who qualify for the credit but are now in jeopardy of slipping through bureaucratic cracks, similar to what the IRS did to deliver stimulus checks. Details of that plan have not been released yet, however. Lisa Janessian, professor of early learning policy studies at Duke University, says the trick will be implementation. Can the IRS do this well and reach all families? Assuming a smooth rollout, the American Rescue Plan arrived at the perfect time for families living under the stress of poverty made worse by the instability of a pandemic. Hughes says this is a bill that recognizes the suffering and unbelievable financial stress that so many families have experienced over the last year. It targets investment toward those things that are going to boost families' ability to raise their kids: stable income, quality child care, increased access to health care coverage, food security. The cumulative impact of these investments is that we have stronger tools to help kids and families recover from what has been the most devastating year that we have seen in our lifetimes. While the economic rescue package was passed in response to the economic fallout of the pandemic, supporters of the plan hope the expanded child credit will become permanent. As it's passed, the credit is temporary and will expire at the end of this year. Sirota says it's about time that such a policy exists, and not just temporarily because the country's in a crisis. We need to be doing this long term. Democratic lawmakers have said they plan to renew the modified tax credits, but may face opposition from a Republican caucus that unanimously voted against the broader $1.9 trillion rescue package. And while the credits are projected to drastically reduce child poverty levels, millions of Americans will still live below the federal poverty line. The United States lags behind other developed countries, which routinely provide generous parental leave and child care benefits. Janessian says, "Whether the current stimulus package will lead to the needed long-term permanent change to address child poverty is an open question. Millions of children were already at high economic risk before the pandemic began, especially children of color. All evidence points to how this racial poverty gap will only get worse. The stimulus package will help, but solving structural inequities will require even broader and bolder public investment." For Arias, a permanent child allowance would at least provide an important new step towards security, giving her the ability to pay off debt and save money for family emergencies. She says, "I would be able to do what normal parents do, such as save for her children's future." It brings hope. Well, our next story is featured on the cover of this Indie Week with a picture of Scott Crawford, Raleigh restaurateur, and it's titled "The Elephant in the Kitchen." And this is as told to Lee Taus. It purports, I guess, to be in mostly his own words. Scott Crawford is a 5-time James Beard Awards semifinalist and a leading figure in Raleigh's food scene. He's also been sober for nearly 17 years. Here, he recounts his own experience with addiction grappling with sobriety in an industry dominated by drinking culture and reimagining the industry's future with a healthier relationship with alcohol. And he begins, I took my first drink when I was 11. It was whiskey, straight. I will never forget how much I enjoyed the feeling of that burn. It was warmth, confidence. It was all the things I was lacking in one sip. I knew, even at 11, that it was going to be an issue. I knew it 6 years later, the day I tried cocaine. I felt so good. I even said out loud, this is going to be a problem. I was the product of a typical 1980s divorce, which were nasty. The year I had my first drink, smoked my first joint, was 1982, the year my parents divorced. As kids, we had a lot of freedom that kids don't enjoy now, and my older brother and I would basically run the streets. You may think, where the hell were their parents? They were just sort of self-absorbed. My brother was a teenager, experimenting, and I was always following right behind. I think we were experiencing a lot of pain without recognizing that it was pain. Back then, the answer was just have a good time, not to reflect or address the pain. If you could party harder, you could party it away. It was the heyday of hair metal and Motley Crue, and we just wandered around trying to get our hands on some liquor or weed in the small steel town we lived in, Meadville, Pennsylvania. I was a skinny kid, less than 100 pounds. There was always a feeling of being lost. My brother was in jail by the time he was 18. When he came home, he was sober, but I wasn't. We moved to Florida, and I set up shop on the beach. I decided that surfing and smoking pot was going to be my career. That's when I started working at restaurants. It was a great way to continue that lifestyle and make money. Kunk House, a little seafood place with deck seating out over the water, was where I found my friends and the people I partied with, where I found my dealers. Back then, we'd make $100 in a good shift, and we might go spend half of it that night, or maybe all of it, on drugs and alcohol. I started at the front of the house, but eventually took a pay cut to work in the kitchen. I realized very quickly the cooks were more like I was. These guys were interesting, rough characters with crazy stories, yet they have this craft that can be artful and really cool. I'd just never thought of cooking as a medium. By the mid-90s, my drinking had gone from manageable to completely unmanageable. I lived an almost underground nocturnal existence. I started college but dropped out and got to the point I didn't want to work a job anymore, so I was just partying and selling drugs, anything that turned a profit. It turned into something way bigger than peddling. I got into fights. I didn't care if I lived or died. But there was a part of me that knew this was not going to be my life forever. It wasn't sustainable. I saw what happened to people. You go to prison, or you get shot. I relocated to Virginia and returned to cooking. Even though I really wanted to get my life together, I still couldn't escape my demons. I made it through culinary school by white-knuckling through the week and partying my face off on the weekends. I graduated early, the first time in my life I ever got all A's. But the night before my first tryout as a sous chef, I was in a hotel room with members of the band Creed doing blow all night. I took a cab from the hotel to the restaurant and somehow got the job. By 2000, I'd made my way into the kitchen of an up-and-coming San Francisco restaurant, Black Cat. It was an inspiring city and changed the way I looked at food. Farmers were selling directly to chefs, and there was a language about food and respect shown that was just way beyond anything I had ever seen. But behind that facade, there were servers using heroin every day. I remember one guy, he didn't have any heroin. He asked me if he could leave to go to the methadone clinic so he could be able to work, otherwise he'd be sick. It was amazing at that point. I was still holding it together, but it wasn't easy. We hired a general manager from Miami who frequented the bar underneath the restaurant every night. drinking after work was an ingrained part of the culture in the industry. We closed at 2 a.m., and I'd go sit on the patio and have a glass of Sauvignon Blanc and a bowl of mussels. I vividly remember sitting there one night, and this girl runs out onto the sidewalk and collapses. She's freaking out, crying. Her friends are comforting her. The cops come, but I don't know what just occurred. The next day, I come in and learn that she was assaulted in the restroom by our general manager. It was all over the media. I left not long after. There's bad behavior. Then there's dark behavior. I was starting to realize just how blurred these lines were becoming, but I still didn't stop. After a decade of hard partying, my body started to give out. I was 31, working very intense 60 to 80-hour weeks, just bracketed by partying shift partying. My skin was discolored and I had clubbing in my fingers. My organs were starting to fail. Following a five-day bender, I realized my tongue was swollen. I couldn't drink enough water and was peeing every 5 minutes. I drove myself to the hospital and remembered the doctors looking at me really weird. One told me, "Your blood sugar is almost 1,000. We've never seen anyone alive with blood sugar this high, only dead people." Once I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, I believe it was the direct result of my body just basically attacking itself. Even after my brush with death, it still took me a year to get sober. Needing stability, I had been working at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company. It was a game changer. There was a lot more structure, but work hard, play hard was still the motto. I regret to say I perpetuated it. Drugs and alcohol were how we dealt with the stress, which was enormous, especially when you start talking about accolades, Forbes five-star lists, and the like. I remember one of my mentors confronted me, saying, "You're failing as a role model." I scoffed. "I didn't sign up to be a role model." "Listen to yourself, idiot," he replied. "When you become a chef, you become a role model." He was right. Whether I liked it or not, I was leading a team. If you teach your people that alcohol is the way to deal with pressure, they will do it, because you're teaching them everything else. The power of being someone's mentor is real, and so easily it can be abused, especially when you bring alcohol into the equation. Alcohol blurs those lines, and blurring those lines becomes an abuse of power. There was no blueprint about how to be sober in the industry. At that point, I had become pretty successful, but I had no guidance. What was I supposed to do with wine tastings? What do I say when people ask me to go out after work? There were not many people in the industry who were sober, and if there were, I didn't know them. In my mind, I was the only one. It felt incredibly isolating. I didn't tell people the whole truth, just made excuses for why I couldn't go out. My rehabilitation consisted of regular AA meetings at a 24-hour gym where I would just destroy myself after work until I could pass out. The folks at AA suggested a career change, but being stubborn and determined, I couldn't accept that. "Why can't you be in this industry and be sober?" Then things started getting better. Not only did I meet my wife, but as a chef, I was going through rebirth. I started noticing my palate and cooking instincts sharpening. I started identifying and appreciating new flavors, juicing vegetables, and moving away from butter and cream. At the time, I was cooking a lighter version of American food that critics described as brighter and more feminine. In the South, barbecue had a heavy hand. I stood out. Cooking saved my life. There was always a passion, but now light bulbs were going off. I got almost immediate attention from the press. Then I started to meet other sober people in the industry, including my longtime sponsor, Mickey Baxt. I started to do the harder work, taking steps, making amends, and dealing with my trauma. I was changing, but it would be years before I started to believe my industry could change too. In 2016, I traveled to Florence, South Carolina, to help my friend Steve Palmer open his new restaurant, Town Hall. I was in the process of launching my own restaurant, Crawford & Son, in Raleigh, after having made a reputation for myself in the city through my work at the Umstead and Standard Foods. With construction ongoing at my Person Street location, I had a bit of time, so I jumped in to help. Steve was sober, and so was Ben Murray, who he'd also called in. I'd known Ben from the Atlanta Food and Wine Festival circuit and always admired how jovial and hardworking he was. He was a positive force, and you couldn't help but enjoy being around him. Openings are tough, but we were sharing stories about sobriety and the old days, and it was a good time. I remember Ben talking about his daughter. Things seemed good for him. What we didn't know was that Ben was suffering and apparently at some point during that opening had relapsed. We didn't recognize it. We were busy, and there was a lot of work. I left to return to Raleigh and got a call from Steve. Ben had disappeared. Everyone thought he'd gone home after the opening. Steve had stopped by the hotel and banged on Ben's door, but no one answered. A few days later, hotel staff heard a gunshot. Ben had taken his own life. Through tears, Steve asked me, "How could this happen? How is this still happening?" Ben had been around sober people, good people who would have supported him, but he still couldn't deal with the pain and shame of relapsing. There was still little support for people in the industry like us. That needed to change. Steve and Mickey Baxt founded Ben's Friends, an industry support group for those struggling with addiction. I started a chapter in Raleigh, which quickly grew. A year later, I was hosting Ben's Friends meetings at Crawford & Son, where we'd share our stories, tackling topics like how to handle wine tastings or how to maintain a group of friends sober. We started to create that blueprint of success that had never existed. One day, it occurred to me that here I was talking with people about how to navigate the industry sober, and yet I was still rewarding a good shift from my own staff with alcohol. When I started Crawford & Son, that I didn't want to seem anti-alcohol, I was scared to be that guy who just eliminated alcohol altogether. If you're the sober guy in the room, people already start to feel uncomfortable around you. So I tried to take an approach that would create a healthy culture around alcohol by keeping a close eye on it. We allowed a beer at the end of the night or a glass of wine while cleaning up. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. But then that light bulb went off. I wanted to be known as someone who creates a professional, safe work environment of learning and growing, not the guy who gives you a beer. In late 2019, we brought in a human resource consultant to help us revise our policies. It was something I'd learned the value of from my time at the Ritz, and real HR training helps people understand clear lines. Going through our handbook, the alcohol policy stood out. We decided to eliminate any and all consumption of alcohol in the workplace by our staff. There wasn't a negative reaction. The people who work here are professionals. They are adults, and if they want, they can go grab a drink after work, just not here. And by doing that, there's no chance of anyone developing an issue within these walls or grabbing one too many. You're not giving them the initial buzz that increases the chance they'll go next door and not be 100% the next day. We're not contributing to that. In the restaurant industry, alcohol is the elephant in the room. It's been blurring those lines for years, and for some reason, we just keep talking about bad behavior and inappropriate behavior. It's my belief that if you remove alcohol from the equation, you can eliminate about 90% of that behavior. These conversations have been happening in the restaurant industry for years amongst those of us trying to move the industry forward in a healthy, more sustainable way. The conversation has changed, but at the same time, we're still hearing these stories that leave a huge black eye on our industry. Peeling away the onion. When you look at these stories, as you hear them, as they are reported, alcohol is involved in all of them. We started the no alcohol policy right before the pandemic, 6 months before the reckoning that Raleigh's restaurant industry witnessed this past summer. There were all these stories coming out. It was heartbreaking. But this didn't just happen last year. It's been years of things happening. Some things were downright wrong, terrible. But there were also mistakes where alcohol was involved that I think were completely unintentional. This is an industry-wide issue that isn't unique to Raleigh, but Raleigh has a very young food scene. It's still learning and growing. There are a lot of big characters, and the experiences of those characters play into it. I'm not going to name names, and I don't want to sound self-righteous, but I think those experiences are important because I can tell you some of the things I have seen in this city I knew were going to blow up. Just based on my experiences, I've seen these dynamics. And believe me, I do not have all the answers. I'm not going to tell you you shouldn't do this or that. I'm just using my own experiences to insulate my organization with policies, processes, and people who can create a safe environment. Well, what does that safe environment look like? For us, it's a place with resources and support systems, good policies that foster good intentions with a vision of coming into work every day so everyone is working toward a common goal and common vision. My job is to make sure things are physically safe and my staff knows that they are important to me and that I care about them so they can come every day and feel like they're in a safe place, free from harassment. Restaurants are truly magical, amazing places with amazing characters, and we don't want to lose that magic. It's intoxicating. People laughing, the excitement, the way someone's eyes light up as they take a bite or their heads nod as they listen to a waitress break down the menu. We need to protect it. By protecting our people, we are protecting energy and magic. And I see it every night when I walk out there. I see my staff and the energy that's created. The magic comes from the people. But the magic can't exist if the culture is toxic. Well, and as I flip the page over from that article, here's an article about food and drink by Sarah Edwards, and it's called Take Out, Take Two. Zoe Deemer remembers the day that the reality of the shutdown set in. It was the hardest work week of my life, says Deemer, director of operations and planning at Acme Food and Beverage Company in Carrboro, recalling March 16th. Our good friend Tom Rayner, the former CEO of Fleet Feet, came into town and said, "Guys, we've got to do something. We have to come up with a plan to support the town. We can't assume anyone else is going to do this." It's hard to remember much from the panicky haze of last spring. And Deemer jokes dryly, "And who would want to?" But as a refresher, as soon as the shutdown became reality, restaurants were thrust into crisis as they contended with a farm-to-restaurant-to-customer supply chain that had been abruptly severed. Nobody knew what was going to happen next. Rayner and Kevin Callahan, the chef owner of Acme, scrambled to come up with a plan. By March 19th, they'd gotten a refrigerated truck on loan from U.S. Foods and launched Carrboro United, an emergency hub of local restaurants that provided contactless drive-through food pickup for customers in the parking lot of Cat's Cradle, a CSA, but for restaurant cooking. For local restaurants, it was a streamlined way to process orders during a crisis. For customers, a one-stop way to source dishes from beloved local purveyors. The curated thrice-weekly menu listed family meals from different restaurants alongside staples like coffee, eggs, and masks. At first, Deemer says, Police imagined restrictions might last a week or two, or at worst a month or two, but then March turned into September, and then another March came around. This past Saturday, Carrboro United reached its one-year anniversary. A few of the organization's 20 employees all paid a living wage, set up shop in the University Place parking lot, where pickups have now moved, and waited for customers to begin rolling in. The staff, wearing masks and tiny orange party hats, were celebrating a few significant statistics as well, including the $1 million that the hub has put back into the local economy and $45,000 donated to the community organizations that Carrboro United has partnered with. Also, the sale of 5,476 dozen local eggs, over 1,000 pounds of coffee, and 1,322 pounds of local mushrooms. Vendors, now numbering 45, include Glass Half Full, Venable, Lady Edison, and Carrboro Coffee Roasters. Vendors, once small-town competitors, have grown into something of a motley collective. Damer says, "We thought the best thing to do was to involve the whole community. We're in this storm together, and we have to fight together. This is not a time to claim territory." Early in the shutdown, Amy McEntee, a Carrboro United regular, was seeking a way to support local businesses while still limiting outside trips. McEntee, a member of several CSAs, was drawn to the ease with which she could integrate Carrboro United into family meals, which, with an 11-year-old son at the table, could go quickly. McEntee says, "There's been enough variety where I feel like I can pick and choose things that are healthy and things that are going to be delicious." She places orders there 2 to 3 times a week. Chapel Hill resident Paul Bilden praises the way the hub has boosted small restaurants and appreciates the weekly connectivity the pickups provide. For his part, he's come to know the staff by name. Meal planning for his family, too, has become easier, and he agrees the operation will have legs even after the pandemic ends. He says, "It takes 2 decisions off our plate during the week. For us, it's incredibly easy to queue it up on Sunday and have Tuesday and Thursday covered." Damer noticed that she says has seen this trend in customers who might order an Acme quiche and pair it with a homemade salad or a box of restaurant pastries and make them stretch throughout the week. Takeout can be an ad hoc Friday night decision. A meal hub becomes routine. Over the past years, restaurants have been forced to reimagine themselves. Chefs alchemized hand sanitizer out of vodka, and restaurant owners concocted a jigsaw puzzle of cocktail kits, specialty grocery items, and heated bubbles. Along the way, Carrboro United has remained a constant for its vendors, growing from an emergency provision to a guiding light for other food hubs, like the Chatham Food Hub and the K.O. Munity Hub in Kerry. It's also become somewhat of a national model. In October, Wall Street Journal cited Carrboro United in a trend piece about the future of restaurants. "The response was just so overwhelmingly supportive from the community," Damer says. "As a couple of weeks went on, it was like, wow, this is a whole business we just created. What have we done?" "We started to firm up an idea of how it could be more than just an emergency response, how it could be a response to a need that maybe wasn't being met before." Restaurants have faced existential reckonings several times over this year and may never return as we know them. Too much has shifted, both for restaurants, owners, and diners. But as Damer points out, the need for eating isn't going anywhere. She goes on and says, "I think this conversation is playing out across the country. How do we change our perception of how a restaurant functions in a community? What opportunity would both serve restaurants and their customers? I think that both the customers and businesses are seeking more stability in the relationship they have with each other. After this year, that has become more apparent." And with just a few minutes left, I will probably not get to the end of this article from the Art World. Shop on the Corner. Emma Kenfield wrote this. It may be pocket-sized, but Caitlin Carey and Skillet Gilmore have big plans for their new neighborhood gallery. At the edge of historic Oakwood in Raleigh, on the corner of East Lane and North Bloodworth Streets, two cherry red doors with square windows conceal a small white room. Through the glass, towering walls lined with canvases and antique cases of ceramics are visible. Tucked away in the back, shop owner Caitlin Carey is likely hunkered over her sewing machine. Carey and her husband Eric Skillet Gilmore have lived in Raleigh for over 25 years. On March 5, the couple opened Pocket Gallery at 222 North Bloodworth Street. Open Wednesday through Sunday from noon to 6, the 350-square-foot storefront features local art in all forms, from Gilmore's screen prints to Carey's needlepoint canvases to jewelry, crochet, and greeting cards made by local artists and friends. Pocket Gallery also features a monthly rotating guest wall located at the front of the store. Currently, the work of artist Davis Schoon occupies the wall, his large clothespin assemblages challenging three-dimensional space. Carey says they are already fully booked with guest artists until 2022, with Autumn Koblund set to take Schoon's place in April. Future guest artists include Pete Sack, Adam Cohen, and Luke Buchanan. Carey says, I thought, well, if I lived in a neighborhood that could have a store, I would love to have a little place to go and get a card for a friend or a gift, and then accidentally spend $2,000 on a great piece of original art. And I'll skip ahead towards the end. Prior to the pandemic, Carey had studio space in the Raleigh Collective Art Space for 5 years. With a shutdown in effect, working from home proved a hang-up for creativity. She and Gilmore finally decided to open the gallery. It was just something about the way it felt when we walked in. It really is tiny. The Pocket is the right name, but there's a lot of wall space, which made me think, okay, maybe I can wrap my brain around the size of the space and I'll really be able to get quite a bit of work in here. Well, our musical artists, Bellows and Strunk, have come in to say, get out of the studio, John. So John Fetterson must say goodbye and remind you all that ncreadingservice.org keeps these broadcasts for a week on our podcast section of the website. So please, everybody, if you like what you hear, come back and we'll have another issue of the Indie Week read. So long for now.